Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Last Friday, the co-working giant WeWork announced it would become publicly traded in a $9 billion deal. That sounds like a lot of money, especially for a company whose original ethos of community and shared working space was conceived in a pre-pandemic world. But it is a lot less than the $47 billion valuation the company had in 2019, the last time it prepared to go public, and before its charismatic CEO Adam Neumann resigned following years of mismanagement and burning through cash. Here is a clip of Adam Neumann before WeWork's implosion, giving a rosy version of his company's origin story.
I'm working in Dumbo, Brooklyn, and in the building there is an architect whose name is Miguel McKelvey. And me and Miguel are talking about different ideas of real estate businesses.
I was attracted and interested in him because he was bringing energy to the room, and perhaps for him I could be a calming element and take in some of that energy that he had and reflect it back at him in an interesting way.
And we went out to build a business that's going to change the way people work, that's based on community and redefine success.
And from minute one with their partnership, it was Miguel who was Mr. Inside and Adam was Mr. Outside.
The world has shifted. It used to be an I world, right? iPhone, iMac, all about me, me, me. If you take the me and you flip it and you get the we, you understand that we're about to change the way people work and way people live, but more importantly, change the world.
That guy is quite a salesman. That clip is featured in the documentary WeWork, or The Making and Breaking of a $47 Billion Unicorn. It is available on Hulu this Friday. Director Jed Rothstein joins me now. Hi, Jed.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
I'm good. So you explain this idea of a unicorn, which is sort of business lingo for a company valued at $1 billion or more. And venture capitalists are always sort of looking for unicorns because it's this investment that'll make a load of money. What does the WeWork story reveal about this idea of the unicorn and about the way venture capital is working?
Well, I think one initial thought of a title for this was The Last Unicorn. Hmm. And as we got further into the story, it became quite clear that WeWork is definitely not the last unicorn, because the entire game of venture capital, or the entire aim, is to hit big, big, big grand slams. You don't make venture capital investments hoping to get low and slow and steady returns. So the unicorn is sort of the representation of what all venture capital investment is going for, which is putting in a little bit of money and seeing it turn into a lot of money, hopefully as quickly as possible. So WeWork really played off that notion within the venture capital world, especially by selling itself as a tech company as opposed to a real estate company, because tech companies, which are sort of the bread and butter of the venture capital world, have much, much bigger returns. And that ended up being a very controversial and problematic stance for WeWork to take as they went forward.
Yeah, it goes over and over again in the film. Adam Neumann is always skirting around the idea that WeWork was a real estate company. He would say it's a social network in real life, even though he's just renting out these workspaces. So just from a journalistic point of view, is WeWork a real estate company?
Well, at the end of the day, that's the core of their business. I mean, they did use a lot of innovative technology in terms of how they designed their spaces, how they tried to help their members communicate, although we talked about in the film the limited engagement that some of those social networks had at a certain point in their life. But at the end of the day, the primary way that they make money is by leasing real estate and then subleasing it to people. And the big difference with that and a tech company is that at a certain scale, if a tech company is successful, it can produce each additional widget for very, very low cost. And that's when you begin to see these exponential growth multiples that venture capitalists are looking for. WeWork, by having its central business actually be real estate, couldn't achieve that. And I think that the tension between wanting investors, and especially some of these very smartest investors on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley and in Japan, as we show in the film Masayoshi-san, wanting them to buy into WeWork as a tech company was really central to their ability to raise as much money as they did and to push their value as high as they did. But at the end of the day, they still needed to sign these master leases. They still needed to take care of real estate, hire people to build it out. And they were, in fact, a real estate company.
One of the, it's so interesting, the documentary, because one sort of silo of it is the business story. And then another part of it is truly getting behind this phenomenon of Adam Neumann. And there's this one great story that I think really kind of shapes it, explains it really well for our audience, is that Neumann's being interviewed and he's at WeWork where they had baristas and he's making a coffee from there. And a journalist orders a cappuccino. And I believe Neumann orders a latte. And when the journalist reaches for the cappuccino, Neumann says, "No, that's my latte." But it's clearly a cappuccino. And then the barista just says, "Oh, no, we call those cappuccinos and lattes cappuccinos." In other words, they the idea of whatever Adam says is right. Like, reality will bend to Adam's will or desire. Why did you want to include this story in the documentary? And how do we see this play out in the business of WeWork?
Well, Alex Conrad, who's the Forbes reporter who told us that story and who had reported on WeWork and on Adam a number of times, told me about that story. And it really sat with me because it's a sort of simple real-world indication of a problematic attitude within the higher-ups, within the C-suite, essentially, of WeWork, which is that rather than tell Adam that something he was doing was wrong or mistaken or that he was believing too much of his own hype, they would just bend reality around whatever he thought it was. And I think at its core, WeWork had a good idea. It was addressing a real need for a different way of people going to offices, and it was addressing a real need that especially young millennial workers had for a sense of community when civic bonds had been torn away. And I think they initially were providing that. But as the company grew bigger and as the pressures from these huge investments caused them to expand at a really rapid pace, I think Adam's rhetoric really expanded, and his belief in his own ability to grow and grow and grow and do no wrong expanded. And within the company, there weren't people telling him, or at least there weren't people he was listening to, telling him to slow down or to do things differently. And I think that that story is really indicative of a cultural change in the company that led to a lot of problems for them and ultimately led to Adam's demise as CEO.
My guest is Jed Rothstein. The name of his film is WeWork, or The Making and Breaking of a $47 Billion Unicorn. So it's interesting. I want to play another clip from the documentary. And the first person we'll hear in this was WeWork's basically kind of an event director who was responsible for these huge, raucous employee retreats that WeWork called summer camps. Then you'll hear Adam Neumann and then a former WeWork lawyer. We can talk about this clip on the other side.
My experience with WeWork, it was like living in another world. It was living in a world where people were just happy, right? They were happy to be around each other. What WeWork created was this environment of present existence and celebrating life with meaning. The world is a dark place, and this little cave of WeWork was my happy spot.
The only thing that stands in the way of achieving anything you want is just you. You know the most amazing thing?
At one of these events, I was sitting towards the back, and there was an older usher there, and it was an African-American guy, and he just started asking me some questions, and he was like, you know, what's the company about? What do you do there? And, you know, I'm answering his questions, we're going on, and he just kind of changed his tone of voice, and he kind of looked down on me a little bit, and he was like, "Brother, can I ask you a serious question?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." He asked me the question. He says, "Is this some kind of cult?"
Was that a fair question from that somewhat wise elder gentleman?
Yeah, you know, it was something we thought through a lot as we were telling the story. You know, what was it, a cult-like? What elements of it were cult-like or not? I think at the end of the day, of course, WeWork was not a cult. I mean, people could leave. No one was held there against their will. No one was forced to carve initials into their pelvis or do any of the things that we've seen in some other films about cults. But I do think it had cult-like aspects to the culture that attracted a lot of people to work there and, you know, probably were effective at getting people to work very hard for maybe less money than they could have made elsewhere. Those events were a big part of the company. They're a big part of the culture of the company. Some people really liked them. Some people found them compulsory and difficult to be around. A lot of people, you know, drinking a lot, maybe allowing for behavior that made some people uncomfortable. But however you slice it, those events helped foster or gave a platform to Adam and later Rebecca and some others at the company to put their views, not just about how WeWork should exist, but how WeWork was sort of a vision, a worldview, or a way that one could move through the world. It was almost like a system. They were creating a system, a different way of living and a different way of being. And those events were really the best platform they had for imparting that to all the people who worked there and imparting it to them in a compulsory way, because they had to go to the events if you worked there, and you had to actually stay and listen to these hours-long lectures. So I think that element of it, you know, compulsory group lecture think, it definitely had some cult-like vibes to it, and I think Don and some others were picking up on that.
You mentioned his wife, Rebecca Newman. She becomes more and more important in WeWork's business dealings, much to the chagrin of some people. Yeah. How would you describe how her role in the company changed over time?
Well, initially the company was founded by Adam and Miguel McKelvey. And their founding myth began with the story of both of them having grown up, at least partly, in communal living arrangement. So Adam grew up partly in a kibbutz in Israel, and Miguel grew up on a commune out west in Oregon. And that shaped many of their initial ideas about what WeWork could become. As the company grew and as that story evolved, as I think founding myths or stories evolve, Rebecca became an additional co-founder. I think her spirituality, her cousin is Gwyneth Paltrow of Goop fame, among many other things. And I think Rebecca had what, in a loose way, you could call a sort of goopy, new agey, loose commercial spiritualism that she brought to the company and really brought to Adam. And that became a bigger and bigger part of what WeWork became. And as that spiritual element was woven into the fabric of what it meant to be a WeWorker, what, in Rebecca's words, it meant to live, to be part of the collective we that we're all living under, which is how she referred to it. She became integrated as one of the co-founders of the company. And it was interesting to chart, to see that evolution and that inclusion of her over time. It was kind of representative of how the company grew and changed and the different directions it took as her influence in the company grew.
I'm sort of curious, you know, as I've read a book about WeWork and I watched the doc, and to me, she seems a little bit like a new age Lady Macbeth, a little bit. in a sense that she's got a certain amount of power and a power over her husband.
You know, you can never get inside someone's intimate relationships like that. But I would say it's true. She certainly had a huge influence over him. I think she, in a way, you know, in ways that became problematic later in their business journey, but that were probably good early on, she gave him gravitas and purpose. I mean, Adam came to New York in this classic way of so many people, and in a good way. He was a New York hustler. You know, he was trying to make it. He was an immigrant. He wanted to start a business. He tried a few crazy businesses with women's removable heel shoes and baby pants with knee pads on them. Both things he knew nothing about, and both businesses that didn't do well. And he finally got into what became WeWork, or started what became WeWork. And I think for him, it was just another business that was a good way to make money. But I think when he met Rebecca, she made him understand that there could be more meaning and more gravitas and more spiritual side to what he was doing. I think she did give him that grounding that he probably lacked. And she helped him sort of harness his own power as a charismatic leader, as someone who could really not just sell things to people, but really get them to buy into an idea and believe in it. So I think that element of it probably was very grounding for him. I think as the company wore on, that became that grew into sort of an absence of doubt, or into what one of our commentators says: if you keep telling a 30-year-old man that he's Jesus, he'll start to believe it. I think late in the game, and especially leading up to their going public, Adam and perhaps Adam, along with Rebecca, just had sort of drank too much of their own Kool-Aid and believed that some of the things they had said as sort of business slogans or corporate pieces of corporate motivation were actually, you know, ground truths about the world that everyone, that would be obvious to everyone. And when they went public, the process of having to really show your guts, which is what publishing an S-1 is, proved that that really wasn't the case. And so that belief became, that belief somehow, that self-belief in self transformed into a kind of hubris, and that was at the root of his downfall.
My guess is Jess Rothstein. The name of his documentary is WeWork, or the Making and Breaking of a $47 billion Unicorn. It'll be out on Hulu this Friday. So you mentioned that S-1. When a company goes public, it has to file an S-1, which is just sort of it's transparency. It's the financial information. It's the business plan.
Right.
And in the documentary, the WeWork's S-1, it's become kind of legendary in not the best way,
yeah,
because of how it was presented. And even people in the film think, we've never seen anything that was quite like this before. Can you explain what was so unusual about it and what it revealed about the company?
Yeah, I mean, you know, usually these are relatively dry financial documents. One of our commentators said, rather than reading like a dry financial statement, it read like a novel written by someone who was shrooming. You know, it talked a lot about the collective we and the power of we, and it had a lot of pictures of, you know, happy, young, creative looking people. And all of this is sort of fine. That's in a way what they were selling. But it also disclosed that they were losing a lot of money, which is something they hadn't been talking about. And it disclosed that there were a number of investors refer to as red flags in terms of the way that the company was structured, money that Adam had taken out of it in various forms, and different insider deals that Adam and others had structured for themselves. Now, these things aren't illegal. It's important to point out. But I think the sheer number of them and the sheer audacity of so many of them funneling power and money to Adam really caught a lot of investors off guard. And one of our commentators was talking to me about this, and she said, you know, a young company, a fast-growing venture capital founder-led company like WeWork, it's frequent when they go public that they have a few of these things. And you kind of, if you believe in the core mission, you kind of overlook them. But WeWork just had so many of them that I think people were kind of flabbergasted by the amount of money they were losing and the amount of these red flags. And at the end of the day, that's what precipitated their very, very rapid fall from attempting to go public at a $47 billion valuation to just weeks later having to be bailed out by their biggest investor, which was SoftBank.
You touched on something very interesting in the film, and Derek Thompson of The Atlantic is one of the journalists who says, like, hey, we got caught up in this as well. It was funny. There's a clip in the film from an Atlantic Live event, and I was actually there that day. I remember watching that interview. And watching Adam Neumann just sort of spin his tail and really work the magic, you know, I don't know the word to put it, the way he was able to bring people in. And Derek even says, you know, he says, like, we didn't necessarily do the best job as journalists here. How would you describe the way that Adam Neumann was able to really tell the story and keep this story about WeWork, which turned out to be a story, not really all true?
Well, you know, Allison, it's interesting. I wonder how you felt that day. Were you impressed by what he was saying, or did you feel at the time that he was selling you something that wasn't true?
I thought it was super new agey, and I can go a little woo-woo. But I remember thinking, he's not even telling me that much about the company. He's talking about the culture and who we are as people and beings. He's selling me a way of life more than a
right.
product. He's trying to.
I mean, that's certainly true, you know, and that became increasingly true as they went on. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Adam, first of all, he is very charismatic. I watched many, many, many hours of footage of him.
He really is.
Secondly, I think the thing that makes this story unique and that really attracted me to it, and that's different than, say, other financial mysteries and other financial you know, scandal type stories that, that I've done or that others have done, is that at the core of it, their idea, Adam's idea and Miguel's idea, was a good idea. I mean, it addressed a real need.
Right.
Logistically and even in terms of the types of communities that we want to live in and that are largely absent from our lives now. So there was a there. I mean, mm-hmm. It wasn't like some Madoff scam or like a film that I had done a couple of years back, The China Hustle, where there were these companies claiming they had 10 factories and they had one or none. You know, there were WeWork offices. They are nice places to work. They're located in nice neighborhoods. You can go and pay, you know, a reasonable amount and get a nice office. So there's a real there to it. I think that's what makes this story so unique, is that it started out with something real and something that probably is helpful. Mm-hmm. And it kind of took off with this rhetoric. It was, in my mind, there's sort of a sense that these slogans that are helpful ways to structure a company began to be a sort of totalizing way of life, and they couldn't freight it. You know, the mm-hmm. the ideas weren't really built to be a complete worldview or perspective, but they were eventually being sold as that, which is maybe what you were responding to, and I think a lot of the people who worked there who liked it at certain points were responding to. And that allowed people to not ask the right questions or not ask them persistently enough about, you know, how does this thing make money, or why is it a tech company, or why are we valuing it the way that we would value a tech company, which often is the case in these venture capital scenarios, where companies can lose a lot of money, like WeWork was, but people, investors, still believe that at some point they're going to hit this inflection mark and they're going to start making a lot of money. And I think those questions were only asked at the point where WeWork had to really stop telling stories about how it was going to change the world and really show its financial cards. And in a way, you could say that the system worked, because when the S1 came out, people weren't buying it, or at least not at anything near that value. But what makes the story so so poignant to me and so emotionally resonant is that, as one of our commentators says in the film, is that that Adam was close, that he was close to doing something really great. And at mm-hmm. the end, you know, whether it was his own hubris or greed or the structure of venture capital that says a guy who runs a company that's losing billions of dollars can walk away with hundreds of millions while a lot of other people involved get nothing. All of these things kind of combined into this toxic stew that led to its downfall. But I think the fact that it was close is what made it, what enticed people maybe not to ask those questions, because we wanted it to succeed, because we wanted it to be, to address real needs that we have as a society and as people trying to figure out a new way to work together.
The name of the documentary is WeWork, or The Making and Breaking of a $47 billion Unicorn. It premieres this Friday on Hulu. My guest has been director Jed Rothstein. Jed, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Allison. Thanks so much for having me.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.